Mothman is the name given to a very strange creature reported in the Charleston and Point Pleasant areas of West Virginia between November of 1966 and December of 1967. The creature was sporadically reported to be seen before and after those dates, with some sightings as recent as August of this year. Most observers describe the Mothman as a winged man-sized creature with large reflective red eyes. It often appeared to have no head, with its eyes set into a chest. A number of hypotheses have been presented to explain eyewitness accounts, ranging from misidentification and coincidence to paranormal phenomenon conspiracy theories. Mothman. In a moment, Charlie McCracken joins us as we talk about Mothman. And then next hour, two guests join Charlie as we talk more about Mothman. And then the last hour, we'll keep Charlie for your questions right here on Coast to Coast AM. Charlie McCracken makes his home in the state of Virginia, has honed his skills as a journalist working in television news regionally and nationally, eventually branching out into documentary filmmaking, for which he has won several top awards. His interest in the paranormal began at a very young age with the tragic death of his sister. He is the director of the soon-to-be-released Dark Wings, The Mothman Chronicle. Now, this is a first feature-length documentary ever produced about the Mothman sightings. He's with us throughout the evening tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Charlie, how are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. And thank you. And how did you get interested in the Mothman story?
Well, strangely enough, this actually ties into Area 51. Travis Short, my producing partner, and I have always had an interest in the paranormal and basically all things paranormal. And we were actually in Las Vegas attending the National Association of Broadcasters convention in April of 01, I believe it was.
Okay.
And being that close to Area 51, it was, had to go, basically. So we took an afternoon and we went up, and while we were there, we went to the Area 51 Research Center, and I picked up a book there by Jerome Clark about mysteries around the world, and in that they had a passage about the Mothman. So I read that day, basically put the book away when I got back home. A couple of years later, Travis and I were in Huntington, West Virginia, working on a documentary film, and got finished a little early in the afternoon and said, what do we do now? Let's get the map out and poke around and see what's here, and found Point Pleasant. And both of us remembered the Mothman and shot straight over there and basically walked into the town and started talking to people. And the more people we talked to, the more intriguing the story became.
You know, your career, much like mine, Charlie, where we started in television news, and we always had an eye and an ear for the unusual. But a lot of times they kept pushing us into the hard news direction. And I'm glad that you were able to break free from that and start doing some of the things that you like to do with these mysteries, because they are fascinating.
You know, they absolutely are. And, a lot of the times with the stories and the stories involving the people who are involved in these types of stories, it's just so much more compelling than working in a standard news environment.
I want you to tell everyone, because of your background in television news, how that turned you into the direction of Dark Wings, The Mothman Chronicle, and the skills that it gave you. Because, like me, I came up as a producer and television news director, but it was the many, many years of producing newscasts on a nightly basis, timing, story structure, pacing of a show, that has helped me tremendously on this program. And I thank television news for that, because that's what really honed my skills. In your case, how did that help you?
Well, like you say, that's absolutely right. It's a matter of developing the discipline also. Where it helped me the most was being able to ask questions in a way that would put the interviewee at ease. A lot of the eyewitnesses are very reticent to talk. They received such harsh treatment during the initial event. A lot of them are called crazy or accused of being drunk or high on drugs. Many of them refuse to talk on the record to this day because of the treatment they received then. And one of the ways that we've gone about making the film is to conduct an extensive pre-interview session with each person, where we'll sit down with them, we go over their experience, and it really, the purpose is twofold. It gives them a sense of where we're coming from, and also that we're not there trying to exploit them or make fun of them. And it allows us to ask better questions.
Were you able to go way back to find witnesses from the 1966 period? How far back were you able to go?
We went back and we've interviewed witnesses from the original sightings.
Wow. Now, there was one, I haven't seen the documentary yet, and I'm going to. There was one in November of 1966, first sighted by a little boy named Lonnie Button. Is that mentioned at all?
Correct, right. So, Lonnie Button. And actually, I was going to mention that because it's extremely apropos. When going over the Coast to Coast AM website this evening, I noticed on the recently added images, number 3 is Spring Hill Jack.
Yep.
And if you go back and look at the original eyewitness accounts from the sighting on November 12th of 1966, it says they saw a brown human shape with wings soaring from behind the trees and flying over their heads. Now, this happened to 5 men who were working on a grave in a cemetery. So, I mean, the cover of the serial, the Penny serial, is basically, you know, dead on for that description from the November 12th sighting.
And, you know, you have to weigh, would 5 guys working in a cemetery make this up? Would it be an illusion? Were they so scared about something else that their minds tricked them? I don't know. I don't know, Charlie, but I think something happened to them.
Well, you know, it's a natural tendency when we see something that we don't understand to try and attach some sort of logic to it. But for the number of people who have sighted the creature independently to arrive at the same point would seem to be just a little too coincidental.
There's a story, November 15th of that same year, 66. Two young married couples, they were on a late-night drive. They passed a West Virginia ordnance works. It's an old abandoned World War II TNT factory. And they noticed 2 red lights in the shadows by an old generator plant. So they stopped the car. They went, hey, let's see what this is all about. Startled to discover that the lights were, what they say, glowing red eyes of a large creature shaped like a man, but bigger, 6.5 to 7 feet tall. And they all say, and this is what's fascinating, big wings folded against its back.
Right.
What can it be?
What indeed. Yeah, that was Roger and Linda Scarberry and Steve and Mary Millette who had that sighting. We actually we interviewed Linda Scarberry pretty extensively for this, and she has an extended segment in the movie. And she is so terrified to this day. We actually took her back to the site where it occurred at. We went in the afternoon on a nice, bright, sunny day. She was still just absolutely terrified and ill at ease to be there.
You could see that on her? Was she kind of shaking?
Yeah, absolutely you can. I mean, that plays on screen. She was literally shaking. Yeah.
What do you think, your best guess? You know, we're going to get into your documentary here, but what do you think they saw, Charlie?
Well, you know, there are a lot of theories out there, and they range, you know, anywhere from some of the pollution left over from the West Virginia Ordnance Works somehow seeped into the wetlands there in the area called the TNT, and it's called the TNT because that's what they manufactured during World War II. They manufactured trinitrotoluene. Its actual name now is the McClintock Wildlife Area, and it's just that. It's like a large wildlife management area. You can hunt and fish and all that stuff, but there are certain portions of it that are absolutely polluted with these chemicals that are left over. And so, you know, part of the theory that some people have is it possible that this is a mutation of some sort?
Can we rule out some guy running around in a costume with wings?
Yeah, I believe we can. Some of the actions taken by the creature, mainly its ability to fly. There are also stories of it leaping from the ground to the top of the North Power Plant on the TNT site. Now, that was four stories high. So I don't think it's going to be a man. And as far as the chemical pollution thing, I'm not so sure about the idea of it being a mutation either. I don't really think that holds much water because you have to remember between World War II and, well, the end of World War II when the plant shut down and the first sighting, it was only about 20 years.
What about a big bird, though, Charlie? Is that possible? Either a thunderbird, you've heard about those
oh, yeah,
huge
absolutely.
Birds, yeah, or maybe one of these large owls that people have reported seeing. Is that possible?
Right. Well, it could be. Yeah, they've talked about the owl also. They've talked about a sandhill crane. But the problem with those descriptions, excluding the thunderbird right now, is the size. These birds are simply not that large. The sighting reports talk of a creature between 6 and 9 feet tall.
That's a pretty big bird.
That would be a doggone big bird, with a wingspan in excess of 10 feet.
When you got into the legends, the myths, and the information about Mothman, stumble across anything that really shocked you?
Well, you know, I think... what really, really took me aback was when I started delving into the background, not only of Mothman, but the entire area, was just the absolute scale of the oddities that have gone on in this area. You can go back to UFO sightings all throughout that portion of the Ohio River Valley, going back hundreds of years. You have the, I don't know if you've heard of this, the Curse of Chief Cornstalk. Are you familiar with that?
No, I am not. Tell me about that.
Okay, Cornstalk was a chief of the Shawnee tribe during Lord Dunmore's War. And upon signing peace treaties, he took up residence at Fort Randolph, which was in Point Pleasant. Became a friend of the settlers there. And lived a fairly peaceful life for a few years. Well, one afternoon in the winter, two men from the garrison there were out hunting and were attacked by some Indians from the Mingo tribe. One of them was killed. The other made it back to the fort, reported the murder and the attack, and others in the fort, in a mistaken rage, basically murdered Cornstalk and his son, Elenipsico, and purportedly, with his dying breath, Cornstalk uttered a curse on the lands all around.
Interesting.
Yeah, and you can follow that down through the years. There's just been so many different things that have gone really, really wrong with the area. You know, you have the Mothman sightings.
Well, you know, November, what was it, December of 67, the Silver Bridge, which connected West Virginia and Ohio over the Ohio River. 46
right.
People die when that thing collapses. Didn't people reportedly see Mothman?
On the day before that, there was a report of men in black in or on the bridge and underneath the bridge doing activities that were reported as almost inspection-like. Now, I don't recall if there was an actual Mothman sighting on the bridge itself in the days prior to or after, but there was definitely this report of the men in black.
So as you began to put this documentary together, when you talked to people and, you know, talked to witnesses, did you have them draw you sketches? Or did they show you anything that they might have drawn over the years?
Well, yeah, we took a look at basically everything that we could in the historical record prior to actually interviewing people. We would put our research together. And a lot of those do contain some sketches done by their own hand, some done at their dictation. In addition to that, the police records and all. And as I said before, it's just really stunning how many of these actually add up and point toward the same general description of a character, even though these descriptions come from separate, wholly separate sightings.
Tell me a little bit about the documentary you're putting together, Dark Wings, the Mothman Chronicle, how it might differ from some of the other things we've seen out there.
Well, you know, we when we first got into this, and when we first started going to Point Pleasant, we really didn't plan on making a film. We were going just out of our own curiosity, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think it was probably our third or maybe fourth visit there that we made the decision to produce the documentary. But I had some very specific guidelines, if you will, in mind that I wanted to adhere to. If we were going to interview the witnesses, I wanted to do it in a way that didn't exploit them. Now, we had basically devoured every documentary we could find on the subject after our first visit, and I personally found most of them to be very disappointing. While most of them had interviews with the witnesses, those interviews were cut up and reassembled into a series of 10-second sound bites and intermixed. Now, that style can be entertaining, but from a content standpoint, they're nearly useless. So I wanted to think about doing long-form interviews, more, say, like a 60 Minutes kind of interview, as opposed to, you know, a soundbite on Extra.
We'll right, say. Right.
Because, you know, I think it's important to hear not only the snippet of the information you're looking for, but what comes before it and what comes after it.
Were you happy with it?
I am. I'm very happy with it. It's a style that's very unlike everything else out there. It's a slightly slower pace, but it gives you the time to actually take in what you're seeing, you know, to absorb what you're hearing, to understand before you're having another image, another piece of content or context thrust upon you.
Did you end with some kind of conclusion, Charlie?
Well, as far as conclusion as to what it may have been, No, we're not. I really wanted to stay away from making that sort of editorial statement. I wanted to go with what these people say they saw, not what I think they saw.
So you keep our minds open to what it might
right. be. Exactly right. And I think that, you know, goes toward the heart of what I said before in not exploiting these people. You know, not taking little bits and pieces of what they say and constructing it into my own personal Frankenstein.
Charlie and John Keel's book, Mothman Prophecies from 1975, he throws in everything but the kitchen sink. Parapsychological events, UFO activity, men in black, poltergeist activities, Bigfoot, Black Panther sightings, animal and human mutilations.
Right.
I mean, he throws in everything in there.
Exactly, yeah. And the opinion you come away with after reading the book is it could have been anything.
It could have been anything. Well, you know, in the British edition of Mothman Prophecies, they've got a picture on a book called Visitors from Space. It was an article that they did. And it looks like the devil. Think about that, Charlie. The devil. We'll be back in a moment as we talk more about the Mothman Prophecies on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we're going to be joined by two more experts here associated with the documentary Dark Wings. Travis Short will join us, Matthew Fleming, and we'll be right back with Charlie McCracken on Coast to Coast AM. Charlie, who coined the phrase Mothman? How did we get that name? Do we know?
Actually, I'm not sure who it was. It was a reporter who was covering the story originally back in 1966. This was at the height of Batman, on television, and also, if I'm not mistaken, there was a Mothman character in the Batman comics.
Ah.
And somewhere along the way, this gentleman printed Mothman, and it sort of, took off on its own, and it's certainly entered the lexicon.
It's
not a very accurate description of the creature, though.
No, and it's misleading, I think, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it couldn't be more un-moth-like. The wings, much more bat-like, membranous. It's just, Mothman just in no way describes this.
You had described Springheel Jack. Tell us what you think could be the tie-in.
I'm really not sure, other than the ability to seemingly fly or leap as Springheel Jack was. And Springheel Jack, of course, goes back to sightings in London of this, what was purportedly a man of this ability to fly. But he would do it by springing, not necessarily through flight as in lifting flight. He would just jump from place to place, but extraordinary jumps, hundreds of yards. There have been some sightings of Springheel Jack in the United States.
Oh, yeah, that there sure have. Some people originally used to say that they thought he had springs on his shoes, but apparently he didn't. And he also had like a Freddy Krueger type hands, razor type hands in some cases.
Correct. And it would wear dark clothing. Had a cape that, in a lot of the artistic descriptions or artistic depictions that I've seen are very much like bat wings also.
What's the venue for the documentary? Television, the big screen, the internet?
We have some theatrical bookings right now, and we're also going to be looking at doing a direct distribution DVD through outlets such as Amazon.com and other internet distributions. We also have some distribution companies that are going to be handling it in different marketing areas.
Tell me a little bit about the eyewitnesses, Charlie, and the types of people you interviewed for the Dark Wings documentary.
Well, most of these people, and they basically were all ages, but they all were just very genuine people, salt of the earth type people. Who really had this thrust upon them? They, to this day, a majority of them won't talk about it. They will not talk about it under any circumstance.
Do most of them still live in that West Virginia area, or have they scattered all over the country now?
There's been a general scattering, but you still find a concentration there in the Mason County area.
Did you find that some of them were upset, concerned? That you would even bring it up after all these years? Maybe they tucked it away, in their deep-seated mind. And then all of a sudden, here comes Charlie McCracken and his team, and you bring it out again. Did they feel uneasy?
Well, one of the things that was a blessing and a curse both was that we really weren't the first people in there to talk about it. There were several crews in there before us. So as far as breaking the ice on bringing this all back out, on rehashing it, we didn't do that. That was the blessing. The curse on that was, we then had to deal with the mess that everyone else had left behind. You would have crews that would come in, and they would promise the sky, basically, get these interviews, and then they scoot out of town, and they're never heard from again, and then the interviews pop up in a million different venues, and these people never end up getting paid. They don't get any benefit out of it. They're basically exploited. Now, what we've done is we've basically allowed them to tell their story. And something that I think is rather unique in the world of documentary filmmaking is with many of them, we've actually given them the option of reviewing their interviews and approving their interviews before we allow them to go into the film.
That doesn't happen. You know that.
It absolutely doesn't. But that was a way of making sure that these people knew that the story they were giving us was the story that was going to be heard, that we weren't going to selectively edit their interviews in order to reach the conclusion that we wanted.
Did any of them say, put that other piece back in or something like that?
No. No.
Nothing. So they were all happy with what they saw.
We didn't have a single request for any changes.
That is incredible. What were some of the stories then that the witnesses talked about on the documentary? What do they range from?
Well, you have, of course, the most famous of the sightings, which was the Linda Scarberry sighting, which you discussed earlier.
Yeah.
Which was they came upon the creature in the TNT area. They're at the North Power Plant, which is no longer there now. It actually was torn down in 1995, much to the chagrin of local tourism boards now, I'm sure. But they encountered the creature there. The creature followed them when they fled all the way back to Point Pleasant. And at times, they were driving in excess of 100 miles an hour.
Oh, my.
And this creature stayed right on top of them.
I mean, could they see, Charlie? Could they see the creature? And was it flying or running?
It was flying, but it wasn't flapping its wings. There was no explanation on how it actually achieves propulsion. It just flew. And the wings remained, they were used mainly for, I guess you would say, navigation. You know, for turns and for banking and rolling, but almost like an airplane.
And did they see it? Is that how they knew it was following them?
They saw it. Yes, they did. And they also heard it as it was scratching across the top of the car, across the roof of the car.
So it was trying to get in.
Yeah, that was the take that Linda Scarberry had. Like I said, she was absolutely terrified that night, and to this day is still terrified. When we finished some of the animation work that we did, we showed her a 3-minute composite clip, which it was astounding to watch her.
Was it based on her description?
It was based on her description. And she began watching it, and the longer she watched it, the more she drew in on herself. But she watched the whole thing and then told us that it was the most accurate and the most terrifying description or depiction that she's seen of what she said she saw. And I asked her if she wanted to see it again, and she refused. She said she did not want to see it again.
I don't blame her. Probably bringing up some bad memories for her, huh? Many nightmares, I bet, for her.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it was important for us to, to get her feedback on that.
You know, did anybody say that they thought these were demons, or this was a demon?
You know, at the time there was some discussion. I can't recall who it was that had brought up the hypothesis. But since that time, it has really taken off, and especially with some of the research and works of L.A. Marzulli.
Oh, yeah. And Lynn's been on the program. He does a great job.
Yeah, he does. He does. He does a fantastic job. Just an absolutely compelling writer. He actually and Travis have struck up a friendship of late. We early on had requested L.A. to do a critical review for us. And in the process of doing that, Travis got to know him. And Travis is a theologian also. So they have a common grounding there.
All right, and I look forward, because we're going to have Travis up at the top of the hour in just a few minutes.
Yeah, and I'm sure he'll have plenty to add on that topic.
When you were finished with this documentary, Charlie, what did you come away with? And I know you didn't tell us in the documentary what it is, because we don't know. But, I mean, personally, what did you walk away with? How did you feel?
As far as what it may have been?
Or what it could have been, what it meant.
Right.
What the reason for this thing to be here? I mean, could it have been an extraterrestrial left behind? Who knows?
Exactly, exactly. Well, you know, my job is basically to tell the story, to relay the events as they're told to me without coloring them with my own opinion. But that's not to say that I don't have one. It seems logical to me that given the sheer number of sightings and the people involved, the fact that the descriptions don't have a great degree of discrepancy, and that those people, they saw something real. They saw something concrete and, to them at least, seemingly tangible. Now, you know, was it a sandhill crane, as some skeptics have put forward? Well, you know, like I said before, no, I don't think it could have been just from the sheer size alone. I don't think you're going to mistake a bird of that size for a 6 to 9 foot tall biped with wings.
What if it was? Did anybody ever say that it was a huge insect? I mean, hence the name Mothman, of course, but I mean, right. Did anybody say it was they thought maybe it could have been an insect?
I have not encountered anyone who said that.
Okay. That would be fascinating. Maybe
that
it
actually,
is.
Actually, that would be very fascinating.
I mean, it's got the wings. It's got the funny head.
Right.
Who knows? Has anybody reported getting hurt by this thing?
Directly injured by it? No. No, they haven't. There was one episode where a woman was startled while she was holding her baby. She dropped the baby and then fell on top of it. But as far as anyone being harmed directly physically by the Mothman, there haven't been any reports of that.
Wouldn't it be something one day if some family cleaning out the closet of their dearly departed grandfather finds a costume, a Mothman costume? Though I doubt that. You never know.
And the big wooden Bigfoot boots.
What about photographs, films from that era? Has anybody ever captured anything on film or on photographs?
There really wasn't anything captured on film or in photograph at that time of the Mothman. Now, you have some photographic evidence of the UFO activity in the area, but not of the Mothman itself. There have since then, with subsequent sightings down through the years to present day, there are some photographs out there that purportedly show Mothman.
Outside of Linda Scarberry, any other witnesses you talked to?
Yeah, several. Just recently, we talked to Faye DeWitt, actually, who she and her brothers and sisters had seen the creature. I don't recall. It was a few days after the original sighting.
Okay. What'd she say?
Well, they had been to the drive-in theater, which was directly across the river from Point Pleasant. Now, Point Pleasant is, of course, on the West Virginia side. Across the river is Gallipolis, Ohio. They had been over there to the drive-in theater, and after that decided, for fun, they'll go look for this big bird that everybody's been talking about. So they get up there, they go to the power plant, and they sight it. Well, her brother, being the more, I guess, bellicose of the group, gets out, starts yelling at it, starts pitching lumps of coal at it. It comes after them. They then get in the car. It backs away and leaps from the ground to the top. And then they turn and retreat.
Lauren Coleman, cryptozoologist, researcher, says that early eyewitnesses never described a moth, but a large bird, which actually was seen and flew from the scene of the initial sightings at that TNT plant. Further, he says the word Mothman was an invention, and you're right, by an Ohio newspaper copy editor. So I've got this just in. After the first news stories of the Big Bird's sightings, and there were some hoax stories tossed in there as well, which always makes it difficult, Charlie, when you're trying to uncover the truth, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And you always have that, though. You know, you always have people who, and I guess it's their way of trying to latch on to some of the notoriety or some of the fame, some of the exposure going on around whatever event it is. You're going to have those people, and you've got to be very cautious as a journalist.
Well, I got to tell you, even if Mothman ended up being a large bird, 6 to 7 foot bird standing up, is a pretty huge bird. That's a story, Charlie, all by itself.
Absolutely. Yeah, it absolutely is. you know, I don't think it would have, you know, no pun intended, it would have the legs that this story has, to use an industry term. Because, I mean, this whole event of Mothman has really had such a life. You know, a lot of things will occur. They'll get some exposure. People will talk about them for a few years. And then there's sort of just something you'll come across in a book occasionally. Not with this. You know, you had John Keel's book that came out in the 70s, which brought a lot of interest up, and then that sort of subsided down and all. And then with the movie that came out based on Keel's book, it just absolutely exploded.
While doing the documentary, did anybody in these regions threaten you or tell you, stop doing this, get out of here?
No, they actually didn't. And I think a lot of that came from the fact that when we first began going up there, and this was before we decided to do the film, we got to know a lot of the people. And one of the things we did was getting to know the right people also, getting to know people in economic development. Getting to know people in tourism, you know, going to the mayor, talking to the local business people. And they, in turn, were able to sort of plug us in to the others, you know, and network our way into it. So instead of, you know, cold calling people and knocking on their doors, you know, we were able to have people do a Godfather call for us. You know, they would call and say, you know, these people are making this movie. Would you mind if they talk to you?
Well, I just came back a few months ago from Roswell, New Mexico, for their 60th anniversary of the Roswell crash. And there's no question that episode, whatever it might have been, brings tours people into that city. Is that the same with Mothman? Is there a place there, let's say Point Pleasant, where they have a Mothman museum? Or exactly. I know they have a statue there. What's
right.
going on?
They do have a Mothman museum. And it's right in the downtown area. It's actually run by Jeff Wamsley, who is an author also and has two of what I think are probably the best research-based books on Mothman out there. Behind the Mothman, Behind the Red Eyes, and Mothman, The Facts Behind the Legend, I believe. But they contain not only interviews with some of the witnesses, but also just a plethora of news clippings from the area, which are absolutely invaluable.
If you had to weigh it, would you say, one, people are seeing something? Would you agree with that?
I would, absolutely. They're seeing something.
And would you say it might be more animal, like a bird, than something paranormal or mysterious? Like a creature?
You know, I'm going to have to lean toward creature.
Really?
I think so, yeah. It's just I have tried over and over plugging in every animal, every creature, or, you know, regular creature that I could think of into that mold, and nothing seems to fit.
Stay with us. Next up, while you're with us, Charlie, Travis Short will join us as well.